Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic? And about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's Classical Christian Curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR9. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He hath loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on.
That's Lee Greenwood singing the Battle Hymn of the Republic. It's a fixture, especially this time of the year here in America. Where did it come from? It's like one of those things you find in your home that's always been there. You don't remember who gave it to you. It's always been in the same place. Oh, maybe sometimes you've moved it around and you're not really sure both where it came from and what it really means. The words of that battle hymn and what in the world is a battle hymn, they mystify us. They seem to kind of be stuck in a different time. What was its original context? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. on this Thursday afternoon, the 4th of July. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We'll spend the first hour discussing the history of the Battle Hymn of the Republic with Dr. Richard Gamble of Hillsdale College. Then we'll talk with Dr. Gamble's colleague at Hillsdale, Dr. Bradley Berzer, about the American Revolution and the French Revolution. Joining us to talk about the history of the Battle Hymn of the Republic, Dr. Richard Gamble, Professor of History and Anna Margaret Ross Alexander Chair in History and Politics at Hillsdale College, author of the new book, A Fiery Gospel, The Battle Hymn of the Republic and the Road to Righteous War. Dr. Gamble, welcome to Issues Etc.
Todd, thank you very much for having me today.
Well, late in your book, you actually compare the Battle Hymn of the Republic to a national monument. Why do you make that comparison?
I make that comparison because of the way monuments function in our collective lives as Americans. If we think about our most famous monuments in Washington, D.C., the Lincoln Memorial, the Jefferson Memorial, the Washington Memorial, these commemorate leading figures in our history, and they, in some ways, commemorate events or they commemorate a certain idea about America. And they were built at different times, I think, to capture different ideas. And monuments have a way of helping us to remember certain things very well, and maybe at the same time to forget other things. They can help us to forget some of the controversy and violence involved in many of these events, and especially in our wars. And I think the Battle Hymn of the Republic has become a monument. It is part of the background. It is part of the way we celebrate America, and in this case, the way we sing about America. And it helps us remember, but I think there's another side to it, in that by commemorating what it does and by singing it so often over more than 150 years, it has the power also to block out some memories of the past. And when we look at a monument, we view a monument, we're often meant to feel good about who we are and what we stand for. There's nothing necessarily wrong with that. And the battle hymn is also meant to help us to feel good about certain aspects of America and America's wars. So I like to think about it as a monument, both as an aid to remembering and as potential for forgetting.
How do you think most Americans regard the battle hymn?
I think it's similar to a lot of our patriotic songs. I think we sing it. We sing it with good intentions. We sing it to mark important occasions, including the deaths of some of our great statesmen. But I think we sing it without much understanding at all. We sing it without reflecting on the author of the words, the occasion that gave rise to those words, and what those words were actually meant to commemorate and to communicate to that generation and to succeeding generations.
It has become a fixture in American and, in fact, the civil religion of other countries as well, to a lesser degree. How do we best define civil religion for the purpose of this conversation?
Civil religion is a difficult concept, and I can simply express it in considering its two aspects. On the one side, civil religion is present in any nation. I just recently returned from the Turkish Republic, and what strikes an American visitor there is how visible their civil religion is, particularly the memory of Atatürk, the founder of the Turkish Republic in the 1920s. It's easy for a foreign visitor to recognize another nation's civil religion, and a little bit harder to recognize our own. So there, certain symbols, certain events, certain personalities are elevated to the status of national observance. We could even say part of a national liturgy. There's a symbolic power that helps unite nations together. In the case of Turkey, a very disparate people with a difficulty achieving and maintaining a unified national identity. So civil religion, and this is true in the case of America, civil religion elevates certain events, documents, ideas, people, symbols, to the level of a national religion in the sense, in the very strict sense, of a religion binding a community together. Now, there's another side to civil religion, and it's the side that I'm more interested in as a historian and a writer and a teacher. The other side that particularly interests me has the most effect on Christianity. Civil religion takes religion and borrows from it or appropriates from it. Think about how many images from the Old and New Testament, how much of the language of the Old and New Testament has been appropriated by America. And that started way back in colonial times. A phrase like God's new Israel, a chosen people, the phrase city on a hill, which I devoted a lot of attention to several years ago. These words are taken from their original sources, and in a way, and this might be a little provocative, but taken away from their rightful owners and turned to new purposes. And what I'm looking mostly at is turned to the purposes of the modern nation state. So it's civil religion in that sense, the appropriation of religion for the purposes of the state.
Tell us about the Battle Hymn's author.
Julia Ward Howe is not very well known today, and I think one of the most heart-wrenching moments is when an author says, well, I'm writing about such and such, and then you mention Julia Ward Howe, and you get a blank stare back, and that worries me. But Julia Ward Howe has been one of the most famous figures of the Civil War era. She's famous as a feminist. She worked for women's rights. She's famous as an international humanitarian. But she's a little different from the person who appeared on the postage stamps in the 1960s. She is one of the most intriguing figures, I think, of the 19th century. She was born in New York. When she married, she moved to Boston and became central to the Boston religious and intellectual and literary world. She was part of liberal Unitarianism in Boston. She was part of the Transcendentalist circle, not herself necessarily a Transcendentalist, but certainly very close friends with that whole circle. She was a poet, an essayist, a preacher. An entire collection of her sermons sits in the Library of Congress untouched. And she's a more complex figure than the kind of iconic Julia Ward Howe, onto which we project all kinds of expectations. She was incredibly intelligent. She spoke maybe seven languages, And she thought a lot about the meaning of history, the meaning of America, the meaning of the Civil War, the meaning of human emancipation broadly understood. And she was a coveted public lecturer and spent many, many decades touring the country and even speaking overseas. So she's a wonderfully complex character that I think provokes a lot of strong reactions.
How did she recount the story of authoring this a poem in its original form?
She started telling the story of the creation of the battle hymn as early as the 1870s on her lecture tours. In fact, a lecture she gave in Detroit, Michigan, is the earliest instance I know of her explaining how she came to write the poem. But she gave it its most memorable form. She gave the story's most memorable form in her memoirs that she published late in the 1890s. And she told the story there of visiting Washington, D.C. in November of 1861. And we can come back to that immediate context if you would like. She told the story of going out to visit the Massachusetts regiments who were stationed in Northern Virginia along the Potomac to protect the nation's capital. She went out to visit with her pastor, a very prominent at the time, very famous Unitarian minister from Boston, and she got caught in a skirmish with Confederate troops when she was reviewing a large parade of Union soldiers. It was very common for visitors to Washington to go out and see these grand parades of Union forces. And fleeing from that skirmish and heading back to Washington, D.C., she got caught in the traffic. And traffic was a problem then, as it is now, around the Beltway. She got caught in traffic. Her carriage was at a crawl. Soldiers were walking alongside the carriage. They were talking. The soldiers were singing to pass the time and entertain their guests. And the soldiers sang their favorite marching song, the doggerel of John Brown's Body. And supposedly, the way she tells the story, her pastor, James Freeman Clark, said, "Mrs. Howe, you should write better words to that great tune." And that night when she got back to her hotel, she went to bed, and she woke up early the next morning before it was even light, and she had the rhythm of the John Brown tune going through her head. And the words then began to flow. She often had these almost ecstatic experiences, these visions, she called them. And later in life, she even interpreted this as a divine revelation. So these words, "Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord," all these words drawing heavily from the Old and New Testament began flowing, and she grabbed a piece of scrap paper and a pencil, and she jotted them down as fast as she could and revised these words only slightly, and they were published not long thereafter, published in January and February 1862.
Dr. Richard Gamble is our guest. We're talking about the history of the Battle Hymn of the Republic on this Thursday, the 4th of July. He's professor of history at Hillsdale College. When we come back, how did this poem, published as it was, become so wildly popular?
Memoria Press now offers 8 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for children with special needs. These full-year packages help you teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art and music, poetry, science, history, Latin, classical and Christian studies in incremental and multisensory ways for mastery. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR9 to save on resources for your home or school.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore, thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
What is the Lutheran Witness? Simple. It's a monthly magazine on faith and life, theology and culture that helps readers interpret the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective. Filled with expert insights, good writing, and inspiring stories, it also provides essential church information for LCMS members. What is the Lutheran Witness? Simple. It's the flagship periodical of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and it has been for more than a century. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today.
Do you dread going to work out?
Performance Fitness in Edwardsville offers a fun, supportive, tight-knit community and environment. Visit them on the web at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. 618-692-5063 or performancefitness618.com. Performance Fitness of Edwardsville.
I have read a fiery gospel writ in burnished rose of steel. As ye deal with my contemptors, so with you my grace shall deal. Let the hero born of woman crush the serpent with his heel, since my God is marching on.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the history of the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Dr. Richard Gamble is our guest, professor of history at Hillsdale College, author of the new book, A Fiery Gospel, The Battle Hymn of the Republic and the Road to Righteous War. So she writes this thing in D.C. after having this traumatic experience out there among the Union troops, a skirmish with the Confederates. How does it go from being a poem that she kind of I'm not going to say dashed off. There's obviously great talent there at work, to being so almost immediately popular?
That popularity is often attributed to its supposed popularity among the Union troops themselves. But I want to step back from that story a little bit. I think there's reason to doubt that the Union troops themselves adopted it. They seem to always prefer their rollicking John Brown's body much better. But the poem that she sent off to her publisher in Boston was scheduled to appear in the February 1862 issue of the Atlantic Monthly. The Atlantic Monthly, still published today, was one of the leading abolitionist journals, but it was a very high-toned abolitionist journal. It covered politics, the arts, philosophy, religion. She sent it off, and it appeared on the front cover of the February issue, and like so many journals today, the Atlantic Monthly sent out advance notice of its publication, would even send out advance copies to other journals and to newspapers. And notice of this poem began appearing in newspapers already by the middle of January. There was a notice that appeared in the New York Times, but the full text of the poem appeared for the very first time on the front page of Horace Greeley's New York Tribune. Horace Greeley was a Whig editor, publisher, and the New York Tribune was the largest circulation newspaper in the United States and maybe even in the world at that time. So that poem reached a very large audience right away in January of 62, about 2 months after she wrote it. And it also appeared in newspapers all over the country. And I think we today, because of our electronic research tools, the amazing tools we have of going through newspaper archives, we're actually able to know better than Julia Ward Howe herself did just how widespread this poem became and how quickly it covered the country. So it appeared in New England, in the Midwest, in the Far West right away. And it was popularized as well by a Methodist chaplain by the name of Charles McCabe. And I won't tell the whole story here, but he committed that poem to memory after he saw it in the Atlantic Monthly, and He taught it to Union prisoners in Virginia later in the war. And they sang this song in the prison after they got word of the Union victory at Gettysburg in the summer of 1863, right around this time of year in 1863. He also used it as he gave lectures around the country about his experiences in the Libby prison there outside of Richmond. And he was able to sing it in front of Abraham Lincoln, and Lincoln came to love the hymn. And its fame spread very wide. It appeared in sermons, it appeared in reprinted versions, and she became inseparable. Her identity became inseparable from that poem almost immediately.
How and why does it come to be called the Battle Hymn of the Republic?
Right. If you look carefully at it, those words don't appear in the poem. And it was her editor at the Atlantic Monthly who decided to call it the Battle Hymn of the Republic. A battle hymn, there were other battle hymns written during the Civil War, and the whole genre of battle hymn comes out of, at least out of the time of the Protestant Reformation, particularly among psalm-singing Calvinists on the continent and in England. And so the whole genre of a battle hymn was well known. And there were also romantic nationalists in the 19th century. There was a German poet who wrote a battle hymn that was extremely popular in the United States, read by school children, especially in the German immigrant communities. So the whole genre of a battle hymn was well known to the American public at the time of the Civil War. And that title seemed to fit it very well, because there's a hymn dimension to it, and it is certainly about battling. But also, if you'd like me to go into this, there's almost nothing in the poem that's specifically about the Civil War, and I think that has a lot to do with its longevity.
Yeah, do go into a little more detail there, because it is full of biblical imagery. It is full of it. We'll talk in a moment about Christ as hero motif there. But it doesn't say anything about the actual conflict that was its context or its inspiration.
That's right. I think if the poem had been more suited to the occasion, if that's what I mean, or more particularly about the Civil War, I don't think it would have endured in quite the same way. It certainly wouldn't have been as adaptable to new uses as it proved to be. If you go through the five stanzas of the battle hymn, it says nothing about the United States of America. It says nothing about the Union. It doesn't use the word North, South. And it really makes only an indirect reference to the institution of slavery. So if we go there looking for a poem specifically about the Union troops, it's not really what we find. There are definitely references to the soldiers' encampments, about their weapons, about their campfires. It does evoke a lot of the images of what she herself had witnessed that week in Washington, D.C. But the poem is much more recognizable, I think, especially to Christians who read it and sing it, much more recognizable for the way it draws from Old and New Testament. The very language of it is archaic, and maybe intentionally so. Now, that can come from its attempt to use an elevated poetic style, but I think it also intentionally mimics the language of the King James Version, even the cadences of the King James Version of the Bible. Even the first words, "Mine eyes have seen." She didn't say, "My eyes have seen," but "Mine eyes have seen." So it uses language that, even if it's not quoting directly from the Bible or alluding to the Bible, it sounds the way the Bible sounds, or it did sound in 1860s America. But then she does much more. She draws heavily in the poem from the prophet Isaiah, and especially how Isaiah is echoed in the book of Revelation at the end of the New Testament. And the imagery there is the imagery of divine judgment. It is wrathful. It is violent. It is apocalyptic. And she brings down to planet Earth, she brings down to the battlefields of Northern Virginia some of the most vivid language of God's justice that appears anywhere in the Old and New Testament. The language of the grapes of wrath, of God trampling out his vintage. This is language of judgment, very familiar from the Old and New Testament, and it's language ultimately of Christ's victory at the end of the age. So some have said, and I read a historian recently who said that American civil religion, as exemplified in Julia Ward Howe, is not really apocalyptic and violent, but this song is, if we understand it, if we read it carefully, if we connect it to its biblical roots, we see this poem is both violent and apocalyptic.
Why did Howe invoke this Christ as essentially war hero motif?
Yeah, and that's a bit of a puzzle that we have to work through, and we don't have time here to put this poem in the context of what else she said and wrote about Christ and the gospel. We have to keep in mind that this is a liberal Unitarian who did not believe one thing affirmed in the Apostles' Creed. She was very modern. She wasn't just a Unitarian. She was a radical modernist Unitarian. Despite her upbringing in the Evangelical Episcopal Church in New York, she turned her back on all of that. And she understood the history itself as, in many ways, what's the right word here, producing or embodying or achieving, winning the will of God inside of time and space. And so for her, God's justice, God's judgment is played out inside of history, in the Civil War itself, in the Union troops. The Union troops for her become an agency of the will of God, of even bringing in the kingdom of God. And her Christ is not the Christ of the New Testament. This is no, and no one should think that this is the Christ of the New Testament. This is not the second person of the Trinity. This is not the incarnate God-man. This is a very modern Jesus who is a humanitarian reformer, the spirit of benevolent reform in the world, an example, a model for us to follow. And near the end of the poem, she draws in a startling way on the very first announcement of the gospel in the book of Genesis, in Genesis 3:15. And she picks up on that imagery of crushing Satan's head to talk about the hero born of woman, the hero born of woman who will crush the serpent's head. And she uses the name of Christ explicitly elsewhere in the poem. And what she means there is not redemption from sin. She does not mean the biblical kingdom of God at the end of the ages. She means Christ as a social justice warrior, we might say today. And we are to imitate Christ by fighting his battles here on earth. And these can be very earthly, secular, physical battles to achieve his will here on earth. So there's a tremendous, to use some Lutheran categories here, a tremendous confusion of kingdoms evident in this poem.
Dr. Richard Gamble is our guest. We're talking about the history of the Battle Hymn of the Republic on this Independence Day. He is professor of history and Anna Margaret Ross Alexander Chair of History and Politics at Hillsdale College, author of the book A Fiery Gospel, The Battle Hymn of the Republic, and The Road to Righteous War.
The Church's Music from the 20th Century. The 17th Century. Jesus has come and brings pleasure eternal. the 11th century. The 8th century. The 4th century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The Substitute Organist Service, aptly abbreviated SOS, really has come to our rescue.
Pastor Jim Hollowatch of Christ Lutheran Church in Jackson, Mississippi.
With the ever-growing shortage of skilled musicians in our community, we were approaching a real crisis. But thanks to the Substitute Organist Service, help is always just minutes away. With its easy, intuitive interface, friendly customer service, and outstanding musicianship, you really couldn't ask for more.
You can find out more about the Substitute Organist Service at churchmusicsolutions.com.
Things when I hear on the radio tonight about Obama being a Christian, but not being good because of his pro-choice and homosexuality stances.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues Etc. comment line.
Yet I see no evidence of any literature that in the Bible that you stated that says that these things are against biblical teachings.
The Issues Etc. comment line, available 24/7, 618-223-8382.
He has sounded forth the trumpet that shall never call retreat. He is sifting out the hearts of men before his judgment seat. Oh, be swift, my soul, to answer him. Be jubilant, my feet. Our God is marching on.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking about the history of the Battle Hymn of the Republic. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Richard Gamble is our guest. He's author of the new book, A Fiery Gospel, The Battle Hymn of the Republic and the Road to Righteous War. You can help support the worldwide outreach of Issues, Etc. by purchasing A Fiery Gospel using the Amazon link at our website. Just go to issuesetc.org, click Listen on Demand. Dr. Gamble, how is at some later point, you mentioned that she was an international humanitarian. She's later accused of hypocrisy precisely because she is advocating for what we would call world peace while having authored a rather violent battle hymn herself.
That's exactly right. And that accusation was launched against her in the context of the Franco-Prussian War in 1870. She promoted an international women's movement around that time for the sake of world peace, believing that women had a special capacity, moral capacity, and as the center of the home in their care for husbands and their sons and their concern for peace and safety, that women had a special role to play in helping to end warfare. But that turns out to be a really complicated question in dealing with her, because she never stopped being a proponent of what we can call righteous warfare. She defended independence movements, wars for national unification. She backed the Italian wars for national unification around that same time. She promoted intervention of U.S. troops. She defended the intervention in the Philippines, and on and on and on. And like so many progressives of the late 19th, early 20th century, she managed to combine, and in her mind, there's no inconsistency here. She managed to combine a vision of world peace and harmony with a determination to fight these righteous wars to end tyranny and oppression. So she has a humanitarian vision, but she's not a pacifist at all. She weds that humanitarian vision with an understanding that the United States will be the world's most powerful, forceful agent for change in the world. And this comes out clearly later, especially around 1900. She envisions the American flag being planted all over the place for the sake of, she would call it, what would be said of her for righteous peace, holy war and righteous peace.
Talk about President Theodore Roosevelt's use of the battle hymn, and as you say, in the name of progressivism, imperialism, and nationalism.
Yes, Teddy Roosevelt was a personal friend of Julia Ward Howe's. They knew each other quite well in the late 19th, early 20th century. Howe, by the way, lived a very long time. She lived from 1819 to 1910, and her daughters were big supporters of not only of the Republican Party, but of Teddy Roosevelt's Progressive Party campaign in 1912, just after Howe's death. He loved the hymn. He wanted it to become the national anthem, and he was part of a movement. He was probably the most visible celebrity figure behind the movement in 1908 to make the battle hymn the national anthem. He thought the tune was great, and he thought the words really captured a vision of the American destiny. He became so closely associated with the poem that there were even a lot of play on words involving him. I have a cartoon posted on my office door, and the caption reads, "The Battle Hymn," H-I-M, kind of a lame pun, but "The Battle Hymn of the Republic," and it's a cartoon of him wielding his big stick, and your listeners may remember that Teddy Roosevelt said that U.S. foreign policy, the United States should speak softly but carry a big stick. So he's wielding that big stick, and he's standing on a mountain that's labeled Armageddon. And that comes from the 1912 Progressive Party campaign, the speech that he gave in the summer of 1912, at the end of which he said that he was standing at Armageddon and battling for the Lord, which is a wonderful expression, wonderful in the sense to be wondered at, a striking example of the fusion of religion and politics that animated so much of the progressive movement.
How did the British make use of the battle hymn?
That was one of the most surprising things I encountered in my research, and I think I make a contribution here in the book to an area we didn't really know a lot about. The British public certainly knew about the Civil War. They followed it very closely, and British public opinion was deeply divided about the Civil War. They knew who she was. They knew about the Battle Hymn of the Republic. But it was in the First World War, during the First World War, when England was trying to woo the United States as an ally to come in on the side of the Allies against Germany and Austria and so on, the Ottoman Empire, that the British started using the Battle Hymn of the Republic as a way to pay tribute to the United States. It became the go-to song anytime the British wanted to compliment America. And for the British public, the Battle Hymn of the Republic became inseparable from the whole identity of America. And when the U.S. Finally entered the war in April of 1917, the British government used the Battle Hymn of the Republic to celebrate American entry. And Americans themselves used it in London to celebrate that joining, America's joining of the Allied cause. And that proved to be very durable. The Battle Hymn of the Republic even made its way into the Anglican hymnal. It is still sung today. If you are in London around Thanksgiving time, you'll be surprised to find out that St. Paul's Cathedral holds a Thanksgiving service for the American community in London, diplomatic and educational. And at that service, they will sing the Battle Hymn of the Republic. So it goes on and on and on, and in some ways became part of what I think of as an international civil religion, an Anglo-American civil religion.
I'm thinking about it in conjunction with the First World War, but especially with the end of the First World War. The hymn itself has such a kind of quasi-divine view of America. It has a very obviously positive, if God is on our side, then obviously a positive view of America and its efforts, especially in warfare. After the First World War, this great disillusionment that grips mankind, does the battle hymn suffer in the minds of the public after the First World War?
It doesn't really suffer. In fact, I would say it continues to be popular. It becomes a standard part of pageantry in America for school children, church groups, 4th of July celebrations. It becomes integrated into American public life, much in the way that it's still there today. But there are two distinct uses of the Battle Hymn of the Republic in the 1920s. Think about the division after the war, as you mentioned. There are many Americans who remain committed Wilsonians, wanted the United States to be central to the formation of a League of Nations, to international cooperation, disarmament, all of that. And they promoted, including her own children, they promoted the Battle Hymn of the Republic as an anthem of international cooperation after the war. But then there's another group of Americans who are more nationalistic, that's a very tricky word, but are more interested in protecting American interests, American security. I hate the word isolationist, but want to take care of America first. And they sang and promoted the Battle Hymn of the Republic as a hymn about America's greatness on its own, apart from Europe, apart from any entanglement in an international organization. So we see the Battle Hymn of the Republic being split in the public mind. We have an internationalist Battle Hymn of the Republic and a more intensely nationalist Battle Hymn of the Republic.
Dr. Richard Gamble is our guest professor of history at Hillsdale College. We're talking about the history of the Battle Hymn of the Republic. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We'll talk about its use in World War II and then later in the 20th century right after this.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
LCMS Rural and Small Town Mission exists to support and encourage congregations in rural and small town settings. In partnership with LCMS districts, RSTM is uniquely positioned to make a major impact in revitalization support, community engagement and outreach training, congregational partnership development, and worker support through providing and developing resources geared specifically to rural and small town congregations. Check us out at lcms.org/RSTM or give us a call at our office. We're here to help.
Others talk. We have something to say. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If you appreciate Issues Etc., talk radio for the thinking Christian, and Lutheran Public Radio, sacred music for the world, please include a bequest in your will or trust for these worldwide media resources. Bequests aren't subject to federal tax or capital gains taxes. Ensure your children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren the opportunity to listen by including a bequest in your will or trust for Issues Etc. and Lutheran Public Radio.
He died to make men holy.
States Army Chorus with the Battle Hymn of the Republic. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're talking about the history of the battle hymn with Dr. Richard Gamble. So how was the battle hymn used during the Second World War?
That's a pretty simple story. I see its use in the Second World War as a replay of its use in the First World War. The British began using it immediately. It was well known to Winston Churchill. His own mother was American, and he loved the Battle Hymn of the Republic, and he asked that it be played at his own funeral in 1965. And also, it was used by Franklin Roosevelt. There was an occasion when Churchill and Roosevelt attended a worship service together during the war in Virginia, and the battle hymn was sung there. And there are stories that about Churchill weeping when he heard the Battle Hymn of the Republic. So it became symbolic. It was appropriated once again for the Second World War to symbolize not just the Anglo-American alliance, but this war against Nazi tyranny.
How did historians and sociologists and perhaps other critics evaluate the battle hymn in the 1960s?
The 1960s was a time, especially the late 60s, was a flourishing time for the study of civil religion. In some ways, the 1960s marks the birth of civil religion as a distinct area of special study for historians, literature professors, sociologists, as you mentioned. And they began looking at the Battle Hymn of the Republic with fresh eyes. Now, some affirmed it as a clear expression of the American identity, of a long and enduring American sense of destiny. But we also have the emergence of some naysayers in the 1960s who are more willing to go back and look at Howe herself, at the origins of the poem, and to cast a more critical eye on its violent apocalypticism, the way it makes the war sacred. There were a number of prominent literary figures at the time who did this, and there were some Southerners, which probably comes as no surprise, but some very thoughtful Southerners like Robert Penn Warren and others who cautioned that the Battle Hymn of the Republic had become a means of national forgetting, that it was a way for Americans to sing about themselves, to celebrate themselves, to become complacent about their power in the world and the power and their capacity for good in the world, and not to think more soberly about the limitations of power, especially the limitations of military power in the modern world.
Was its association with the civil rights movement simply a 20th century extension of its association with the Northern cause?
I think its association with the Civil War is the most expected and least ironic use of the battle hymn. It appeared very early in the movement, in the 1950s. It was being sung at sit-ins and protest rallies, and then most famously taken up by Martin Luther King, and he quoted it in many of his speeches. So I think the civil rights movement had the best claim on the battle hymn. There is a bit of a shadow over this because Julia Ward Howe's own racial views, while she was an abolitionist, a staunch abolitionist, her own racial views were not very enlightened. She doubted the black capacity for self-government and improvement in America. But still, the civil rights movement, I think it's only natural that they would have taken hold of the Battle Hymn of the Republic and used it in their protests and campaigns.
You write this, like so much of America's national religion, it is a song of affirmation of faith in self while sounding so much like faith in God. What does that say about American civil religion in your mind?
American civil religion ought to be a critical concern for confessional Christians, serious Christians who take their faith and their Bible and their church very seriously, ought to be alert for the intrusions of civil religion, ought to be wary and guarded about how the modern state appropriates the Bible and their faith. I think this happens in ways that are often very subtle. And one of the things I'm struck by in my own research is how often this has been a voluntary act on the part of churches, preachers, evangelists. The church in America, for reasons that need more exploration, Christians in America have too often been too willing to speak of their nation way beyond patriotic terms, to speak of their nation in divine terms, in redemptive terms, and have helped to transform a very earthly kingdom into a sacred kingdom, into an agency of the work of God's redemption in the world.
In what sense can we call the Battle Hymn of the Republic our other national anthem?
It has certainly served as an informal national anthem, even though it wasn't picked in the 1930s when Congress finally chose the Star-Spangled Banner. It has endured as at least an equally popular song, and I would say in certain civil ceremonial contexts, it is much more popular than the national anthem, the Star-Spangled Banner. So it, along with a song like America, the Beautiful, and a couple of others, it endures as an unofficial, informal national anthem, and it seems to have great durability and great popularity, and I don't expect that popularity to diminish.
So finally, how does the history of the Battle Hymn demonstrate Americans' uncanny ability to sometimes forget their own history?
Americans have earned a reputation, I think, deserved in many ways, of a place that forgets. And there's a good side to that. Many immigrants come to America wanting to forget about the hardships, oppression, suffering of their own homelands, and they like to start over in America, and they would like their children not to have to remember what they've been through. So there's a fairly positive side to that, this knack for national forgetting. But I think it's very risky, and if I could just draw the analogy to our own individual self-knowledge, right? We must know ourselves. That's one of the oldest injunctions in Western civilization. And a nation must know itself. And part of knowing itself is to know the bitter parts of its own past, to know its violence, its wars, its injustices. And singing a hymn like the Battle Hymn of the Republic can actually make us forget, and I know this sounds so paradoxical. It is a song about the Civil War. It is a song about battle. But it is so celebratory that we can forget how many people have suffered and died in these wars that we celebrate. I don't want to be misunderstood. There is a time to fight. There are just wars. But we must not sing about our wars in a way that blinds us to the degree of human tragedy embedded in every war.
Finally, you write that the Battle Hymn of the Republic, quote, served as a song of innocence. With about 30 seconds, what do you mean by that?
It enables us to sing about ourselves in such a way that we don't confront irony and tragedy in our history. And in that sense, it is a song of innocence. It keeps us simple-minded in a way. It blinds us to all the things I've been mentioning. It blinds us particularly to irony and tragedy in our own past.
Dr. Richard Gamble is professor of history and Anna Margaret Ross Alexander Chair in History and Politics at Hillsdale College. He's author of the new book, A Fiery Gospel, The Battle Hymn of the Republic and the Road to Righteous War. You can purchase A Fiery Gospel under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. Dr. Gamble, thanks.
Thank you, Todd.
Dr. Gamble's colleague at Hillsdale College, Dr. Bradley Berzer, is up next to compare and contrast the American Revolution with the French Revolution. I'm Todd Wilkin. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Nadia Bowles Weber calls for a sexual reformation in her latest book, Shameless. How does her reformation compare with the truths rediscovered during the 16th century Reformation? I've written a review of Shameless in the latest Issues Etc. journal. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button on the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Pastor Andrew Abraham details his journey from Catholic priest to Lutheran pastor. The free online Issues Etc. journal.
Do you want a church with a rockin' band and a sermon series to help you live a better life? It's not here. Bethany Evangelical Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights offers authentic, historic Christianity to a world awash in fads and entertainment, and offers forgiveness of sins to people overwhelmed with guilt and shame. Join us Sundays at 9:30 on Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights, Illinois, to receive the life-giving gifts of God with us. Find out more online at bethanylcms.org.